From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the holy grail of plant biology, plus a double helping of the bard, along with a side of greater tuna. It's this year's Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. First, Sacramento's best-known new media company will soon merge with a bigger East Coast rival. Last week, digital music group announced it would be taken over by The Orchard, a New York-based company that also works in the digital music distribution business. It's scheduled to happen in the fall. In the meantime, digital music group's founder, Mitch Kalouris, is exiting as president and CEO. The company's CFO is taking over as interim boss until the deal with The Orchard closes. Why did DMG agree to disappear? What will happen to its 36 Sacramento employees? And what will the company's founder do next? The best person to answer those questions is Mitch Kalouris himself, and he's in our studio. Mitch, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Why is Digital Music Group going away?
Well, I don't know that it's going away. The company is going to a whole new level. I mean, we have been in discussion with The Orchard for some time on and off since late last year. And in this particular go-round of talks, it just seemed like the right situation and the right time. There's a lot of synergies between the companies. It creates the biggest digital entertainment aggregator distributor in the world. So we think that's, you know, quite compelling to the shareholders, and that's why we did it.
In a sense, though, it's going away because it's being folded into another company, and the name Digital Music Group will no longer exist.
That's true. However, the DMGI symbol will still be the trading symbol on the NASDAQ stock exchange. So
why is that?
I actually don't know. It's probably simpler to keep it than to change it.
I see. But doesn't The Orchard have its own NASDAQ symbol?
No, they don't. They're a privately held company.
I see. Okay, so for years people will be asking The Orchard, why is DMGI your
That's
NASDAQ
right.
symbol?
That's exactly right.
The story about this deal that I read on sacb.com, the Sacramento Bee website, there was one person commented at the end saying, never heard of either company. What exactly does Digital Music Group do?
So Digital Music Group is an owner of content, music content, audio recordings, as well as a distributor of audiovisual and audio recordings.
Meaning so, you own recorded songs.
Yeah, we own master recordings to, boy, either the digital rights or the master rights to well over 30,000 tracks of music. And then we distribute under long-term license or short-term deals, you know, another, you know, 360,000. So all total, DMGI has approximately 350 to 400,000 tracks of music and another 6,000 hours of video content, classic TV, children's and animation, extreme sports, and so on.
And when would actual consumers of music come in contact with Digital Music Group, even if they didn't realize it?
Well, as you shop the aisles, the virtual aisles of the iTunes Music Store, Napster, Real Rhapsody, you can encounter all of our music there, either through download or through subscription services. So we make our music and video content available through these other consumer destinations, and that's how you consume it.
All sounds very high tech, but there was an element to this that was, I guess, in a way low tech. You had some guy at your offices sort of ripping CDs and reformatting them.
That's kind of what we do, right? So, in order to get the product to market, if you will, at iTunes, that requires us to do a number of conversions from physical goods, whether it's a CD or magnetic audio tape. So most of the recordings we get are provided on compact disc, as you can imagine. We have an automated system for ripping the audio files to a master wave file on our server, and then we do some data entry on the metadata, the artist, title, genre information, marry the two together, package it up into a digital electronic package, and then push it out to iTunes and the rest of the digital entertainment services, and that's how product gets available for sale.
My guest is Mitch Kalouris, the exiting president and CEO and the founder of Digital Music Group, a Sacramento company that acquires the digital rights to music recordings and then formats them for distribution to online music stores. He's stepping down and leaving the company as it prepares to merge with The Orchard, a larger New York-based rival. Did Orchard basically do the same thing, but just on a slightly bigger scale?
Yeah, I think we see a lot of complementary things between the two companies. Orchard is primarily focused on music. And while we started our company and established our company in the digital music space, we also have expanded it into the digital video space. So we've actually got quite a bit more traction and are much farther along in that business than they are. So when you bring the two companies together, it combined is over 1 million tracks of music available through iTunes and other places for sale. And again, you know, the 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 hours worth of video. So the Orchard, you know, does all of those things as well as the marketing services that you would expect as we do.
Did you think about trying to buy them?
You know, that's all in the dance and the negotiation, right? So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we had investment bankers and so forth, you know, involved in the transaction, attorneys, as you can imagine, accountants and auditors. And, you know, we go to those folks for advice on fairness opinions and so forth on valuations. And that's the deal we came up with that was established last week.
Have either DMG or the Orchard been profitable yet in this business?
Neither one of us has been profitable. All of the numbers have been announced in last Wednesday's press release in terms of revenues and profits. It's suffice to say that there's significant synergies between the two companies. And, of course, profitability is the key to any business. Otherwise, you won't be around very long. So, you know, that's obviously the goal, and to get as many of these synergies out as possible.
Did you agree to merge with the Orchard because you couldn't see profitability in the foreseeable future?
I don't think so. In fact, you know, we are on our plan, and we figured, you know, we've established a plan with our board. We have been on that plan. The decision to merge wasn't based on our, you know, not having a viable business, not at all. I think we thought, look, how can we take this to a whole new level? How can we establish really the biggest and most compelling digital entertainment company of its kind in the world? And by merging with the Orchard, that's exactly what we've done.
Mitch Kalouris is the exiting president and CEO of Digital Music Group. The company went public in early 2006, and stocks are trading at first at about $10, and they quickly fell to about $4.50. And since then, for the last year, they've basically been bouncing around the $4 to $5 range. Were you under pressure from people who invested in the company?
Well, I think that on the IPO, certainly we weren't happy or we were disappointed, at least, with the results so far. I think the difficulty with most investors is finding a comparable company to ours. There really aren't any comps out there in the market. So I think the market understanding our business and how we do what we do, what the revenue model is, and so forth was, you know, took a bit of handholding, to be honest with you. However, you know, while the, you know, so in some, at some level, my performance is based on the stock price, and if the stock price is down, obviously that, you know, that is not a good thing. So, you know, we were very conscious of that. We, you know, myself and my CFO, Karen Davis, have been, you know, constantly communicating with investors who invested in the company early on and since the IPO, and, you know, trying to communicate all the things they need to know about our business.
It seems to me that the DMG and the Orchard and I guess other companies in the same line of business are really in the middle here. Mm-hmm. Why is there a need for someone in the middle? Why couldn't iTunes or Yahoo Music do this kind of work themselves? Or conversely, why couldn't artists or their record labels do the same thing? Why couldn't they have a building in Natomas and rip CDs and then just, you know, email them over to Yahoo?
Well, that's two different things. First off, you know, if you're an artist or a label, you have to have direct deals, you know, with the various digital entertainment services, Yahoo's and iTunes of the world. And frankly, that's not easy to do. You know, iTunes and Napster and the rest, frankly, are under a lot of pressure and get pulled in a lot of directions as well. If you can imagine, having thousands of direct relationships becomes somewhat of a challenge for them. So having a company like ours to be sort of that go-between, to make sure that not only we're bringing them a lot of content, but that it's submitted in the proper way technically, is really, really important. The reality is that doing digital distribution isn't that simple. It's not a simple process. Every single digital entertainment service has its own format. So unlike the physical CD business or DVD business, in fact, where you have a replication master, finished product, and you duplicate that number of times, tens of thousands of times, send it to every store in the world, and consumers buy it and then play it on every player in the world. Not so in digital, the digital space. iTunes has a separate formatted encoding scheme than Napster, Yahoo, MSN, and the rest. So when you think about, gee, I'm an average label and I'm trying to get in the game in digital distribution, what it really requires is programming, technical infrastructure, hardware, and time. And frankly, it's probably from a ROI cost-benefit point of view, it's just not worth it. So they use companies like ours.
What about the Sacramento employees of Digital Music Group? There are about 35, I read. What's happening to them?
Well, everybody has been encouraged to stay on. We've put forward a plan for the company and the employees to date until the merger is actually closed, which will be in the late part of September, early October, at which time over the next 45 days or so, it'll become clear what roles, if any, these employees will play. So that plan is still to be determined. We haven't made any formal announcements to the employees or to the press or otherwise about the Sacramento and San Francisco operations.
But will the company be based in New York where the orchard is?
Yeah, the headquarters will be in New York. That's where the management team will be, and that's where the headquarters will be.
You own hundreds of thousands of DMG shares.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to them?
Well, they're still mine. That's the good news for me. You know, I started the company, you know, 3.5, 4 years ago, and it was really sort of born out of looking at what's happening in digital media and saying, gee, there's really something interesting going on here, but really couldn't put my finger on it. And it was like a year of really thinking about it until really the light bulb went on, and it was sort of that aha moment for me and saying, ah, I got it. Here's what the business model is and so forth. So, you know, the company was built specifically to take advantage of what's happening in digital media, first in music and now in video. We had a lot of local investors early on in two different rounds of financing. And, you know, all of those investors got in early and it'll do quite well. For me, if they do well, I'll do well as well.
Because your shares will now be Orchard shares. Or will
Yeah, DMGI shares still.
Oh, yes.
There's just more of them. We're issuing new shares, as you know. So those are shares that I own, and that's it.
Well, you'll be a big shareholder then in the Orchard.
Well, I've been the single largest shareholder in the company from the outset. So
are you going to stay involved?
Only from the standpoint of, you know, if the company wants my input and advice, I'm happy to be available. I haven't had any official or unofficial capacity yet, but of course I'm open to that. I've obviously spent a lot of time thinking of and, you know, working in this space for the last several years. I've made a lot of friends and relationships and, you know, obviously I have a vested interest in seeing the company do well.
But why step down? I mean, you're a pioneer in this business. Is this just the way it goes that when you got two CEOs of merging companies, one of them has to go?
Well, you certainly don't need two, that's for sure. So, you know, I think I'm fairly philosophical about it. I mean, look, you know, the company, if you asked me 3.5 years ago, would we have gotten this far? Would if we have done the initial financings, have gone public, and now have built the biggest digital entertainment company in the world? I've said, gee, sounds like a great dream, but probably not likely. So, you know, I think I've accomplished everything I set out to do from the inception and more. So I think this is just the logical time, place, and situation for me to step aside, hand it over to a new management team, and see it go to a whole new level.
You started out at Tower Records. What did you do there?
Well, when I was a kid, when I was 17, I was just a lowly clerk and a music lover, and worked there through college. And then after college, went to work in their corporate offices here in West Sacramento, where I actually developed their first computerized database tracking system for inventory control, purchasing, sales reporting, and so forth. And so that led to a company-wide initiative to get computerized. And so that was my role at Tower.
Did you get the idea for Digital Music Group when you were at Tower?
You know, I can't say that I was that visionary, but certainly after I left Tower, you know, you'd see the advances in technology, first with CD burners, with the internet, first with, you know, things like CompuServe forms, and then the internet after that, and saying, gee, you know, there would be an interesting opportunity if you could just acquire music or purchase music directly from a record company. They certainly have these master files and could easily be transferred online. But of course, back then it was all about infrastructure and technology at the time.
You left Tower in 1990, mm-hmm. which was well before the web sure. became what it is today. Tower Records is now out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why it went out of business, it seems to me, is that it did not adapt very quickly or very well to online retail.
That's right.
And
the changing landscape of
yes, there were many
brick
other
and
things.
Mortar as well.
Yes, there were many other things went on. I realize that. But Tower didn't seem to establish much of a presence for itself on the internet. Do
yeah.
you think that might have been different if you'd been there?
I don't know. I mean, the company's culture was very different than a lot of companies I've worked with. And I've been involved with many, you know, companies like Borland Software Corporation, Oracle, Microsoft, and some of the other high-tech companies. Towers was a very interesting culture, sort of family-oriented culture, which can kind of cut both ways, frankly. I think that, you know, the company was had its political struggles that internally that it just couldn't overcome, and a lot of sort of internal dynamics that prevented itself from sort of getting out of its own way and adapting to the market, both in brick and mortar and then with the internet. I think if it leveraged its online property at TowerRecords.com and Tower.com, that to better sort of leverage deep catalog sales rather than use that for the stores, they probably would have done much, much better.
So but you think it could have, Tower could have remained viable if it had adapted differently to the internet?
Yeah, I think my observation, when I left Tower, I sort of left, right? I didn't look back and said, thank you very much for the opportunity. But I think, you know, all of this hindsight being 2020, you know, it's one of these things where when I did, you know, go into a Tower record store, it just didn't seem like the stores really sort of adapted to sort of changing world around it. It was always sort of trying to throw things like small electronics and things like that into the mix to sort of help, you know, stimulate sales, but not sort of step back and look at the overall strategy for the company, where you had companies like Barnes & Noble and Borders and so forth, you know, coming in and having, you know, very good shopping experience for customers. So, and then you've got the big box retailers, the Best Buys and the Walmarts of the world on the other side. And so, you know, Tower kind of got caught in the middle.
Have you gone down to Broadway to check out Russ Solomon's new shop, R5?
I haven't. You know, I actually, you know, drink the Kool-Aid that I speak. And that is, I haven't bought a CD in years. I download all my music from iTunes.
Yeah. And what are you going to do next?
Well, as you can imagine, you know, I've made a lot of friends over the years, I've had a lot of opportunities since the announcement. You know, this has been kind of kept under the sheets, so to speak. So now that it's out, I've had a lot of people inquire about my availability, and you know, I'm talking to a number of people actually for various opportunities. So right now, it's a little too early to tell. I'm still finishing up my stint with DMGI and this transition and, you know, kind of buttoning up all the pending business. And so we'll see. But you can rest assured, people who know me know that I don't sit still for very long.
You plan to stay in the Sacramento area and stay in the online music business?
Well, you know, all of my experience to date has been in digital entertainment, both in video and music. So I suspect that I'll be involved in that industry in some way, whether it's here or in some other area. It's really tough in Sacramento just because of geographically where it is. I mean, really, you know, the business is really in, you know, Los Angeles and New York. And, you know, we'll have to see where that ends up landing me physically. But, you know, suffice to say that I'll be in this industry for sure.
And finally, Mitch, if you could go back to before the creation of Digital Music Group, anything you'd do differently?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I really sort of put my heart and soul into the opportunity and sort of the vision for the company. And, you know, people who worked with me know that, you know, I was always the first one in the morning and always the last one to leave. You know, did a lot of red eyes and a lot of travel, you know, to sort of, you know, get down and lead by example. So, you know, I don't think so. Of course, you know, in the public company situation, it's very different than being a private company. There's lots of, you know, you're sort of all of your laundry's out there for everybody to see and, you know, to ask questions about. So it was very, very much a learning opportunity for me, which I really, really appreciated. So I can't really say that I'd do anything much differently. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, put their faith and confidence in me. And I just appreciate the fact that a lot of people believed in the vision and were able to ride along.
Mitch Kalourdis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mitch Kalouris is the exiting president and CEO, and he's the founder of Digital Music Group, a Sacramento company that acquires the digital rights to music recordings and then formats them for distribution to online music stores. He's stepping down and leaving the company as it prepares to merge with The Orchard, a larger New York-based rival. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a double helping of the Bard, along with a side of Greater Tuna. It's this year's Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. We'll be right back. Listening to Inside from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Cities located in Middle America lead the U.S. in volunteering, according to a new study. On the next Insight, how does the Sacramento region stack up against the nation when it comes to volunteering? Plus, a local volunteer agency tells you how to get involved. Summer is Shakespeare Festival season. There are plenty of festivals to choose from if you're willing to travel. One thing the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival certainly has in its favor is its backdrop. The productions are presented in an outdoor theater. On this year's bill, a romance, a comedy, and a helping of tuna. The Shakespeare plays are Romeo and Juliet and The Taming of the Shrew. The third play is that popular piece of comic Americana, Greater Tuna. Our first guest on this topic is Catherine Atack. She's executive director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. Catherine, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
Why did you decide to put Greater Tuna on the bill along with the Shakespeare plays?
Well, we decided actually when we first built the facility at Sand Harbor, which happened in 2000. We've actually been there since 1976, but we built a permanent stage facility in 2000 that we wanted to be able to maximize the use of that venue and offer a little bit more diverse offering other than just Shakespeare, as many Shakespeare festivals do across the country. So Tuna is one of the first opportunities we've had to do that. Last year we presented the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, which, as many of your listeners probably know, is a contemporary take on all of Shakespeare's work that's done in about 2 hours. So Tuna's the next step along from that. It's nothing at all to do with Shakespeare, as I'm sure everyone realizes. So it is the first ever non-Shakespeare contemporary play that we've done at the festival.
And what's been the early reaction from your supporters and from people going to see the show?
They're delighted. And whereas Shakespeare is a wonderful opportunity and really good performance series that we've been offering for some time, it's not everybody's cup of tea. And so we wanted to do something that was a little bit different. So people are very thankful for that. And in fact, we opened the season at Sand Harbor Amphitheater with a performance by the Reno Philharmonic on July 9th, which was extremely well received. And after Shakespeare closes on August the 19th, we offer Midsummer Nights, which is a compilation of performing arts groups from around the region, including the Sierra Nevada Ballet and Lake Tahoe Chautauqua and the Reno Jazz Orchestra, and also a group called Choosy Entertainment, who are doing an originally crafted work, and many of their performers have prior lives in Cirque du Soleil. So that's rather an exciting endeavor for us to get into as well.
Sounds like you're from the land of Shakespeare.
That's true, yeah. Uh-huh. From Yorkshire, originally.
Okay. Now, you're the executive director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival, but your professional background is in public relations. How did these two come together?
Shakespeare was my client, so that's similar to many people going from one thing to the next. That's how that relationship evolved, and it's been quite successful, I think, for both of us in that time.
Also with us is Scott Gilbert, who's an actor and director in the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. He plays Lord Montague in Romeo and Juliet and directs The Taming of the Shrew. He also happens to be artistic director of the Foothill Theatre Company. Scott, welcome to Insight.
Good to be with you, Jeffrey.
So, what do you prefer, acting or directing?
Well, when I'm doing one, I'm always thinking about, wouldn't it be nice if I were doing the other? But the best thing about my job is getting to do a little bit of both. It's nice to be able to go back and forth. But I suppose directing is the thing that I love the best.
I guess this keeps you busy, because if it's not one, it's the other.
Yeah, I'm always jumping around trying to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing.
Now, as I said, you play Lord Montague in Romeo and Juliet. Can you give us a quick a quick guide to Lord Montague. Who is he, and what is his relationship to Romeo and Juliet?
Well, one of the central factors of the play Romeo and Juliet is that Romeo is a Montague and Juliet is a Capulet. And the Capulets and the Montagues are the Hatfields and McCoys of this particular play. And so I'm the father of Romeo. Lord Montague is the father of Romeo. And it's our age-old feud between the two families that keeps Romeo and Juliet apart and leads to all the problems and tragedies that occur during the course of the play when they fall in love.
And how big a part is Lord Montague?
Lord Montague is not a really big part. It's got a couple nice little scenes. And then I also play, I get to play a couple small roles like Friar John because I have plenty of time to switch back and forth.
How much of a background do you have in acting Shakespeare?
Quite a bit. I've been doing it for 20 years or so, and I've acted Shakespeare and directed Shakespeare all over the country at various theaters. And then I've been with the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival for, this is my sixth year. So Shakespeare is one of the things that I love to do and that I've had quite a bit of opportunity to do, which is great.
Catherine, as we noted earlier, you're from England, and I'm from the UK myself originally, and I know there's a little bit of snobbishness in some circles in the UK about Shakespeare in America. How do you feel about the way Shakespeare's done in the United States?
My experiences have primarily been on the West Coast and in New York City, and I think that it's quite well done, actually. And one of the things that American Shakespeare tends not to be is boring, and that's so that's one of the ways to keep audiences coming back is to update the storyline. And of course, a lot of what Shakespeare wrote can transcend quite nicely into modern day context. So. Certainly something a play like Romeo and Juliet, I'm sure Scott would agree with this as well, is very relative to some of today's issues, certainly with teenagers and gang violence and rivalries and being able to come together in the end and realize that ultimately we're all the same people. So I think the quality of the productions that I've seen in the USA have been quite good, actually.
Scott, how much Shakespeare have you seen in the UK, and how would you compare it, the overall standard, to the standard here?
I'm not greatly familiar. I haven't spent a lot of time in the UK, so I don't know too much. I know a little bit about the controversy. I think a lot of that is overblown because of Shakespeare being from England, but of course he was from a very different England than modern-day England.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things we try to do here at Tahoe is do exciting Shakespeare that grabs people. And on either side of the Atlantic, the kind of theater I like and the kind of Shakespeare I like is exciting theater that grabs people and really excites them and makes them want to watch more. And if those British individuals who think that a more boring style is best, I certainly would not agree with them. But I know there's thrilling, exciting Shakespeare that's done all the time at the RSC.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And at the National.
The Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theater in England.
But
we're talking about the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. On the phone, Scott Gilbert, who's an actor and director in the festival, and Catherine Atack, who's the executive director of the festival. Now, the other Shakespeare play, in addition to Romeo and Juliet, is a less well-known Shakespeare play. It's The Taming of the Shrew. And Scott, you direct this one.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the thumbnail sketch of The Taming of the Shrew.
Well, The Taming of the Shrew is one of Shakespeare's funniest plays. It's just got a lot of hilarity, and it's one of the less serious ones. But it's also a little bit of a problematic play in that it's about Petruchio, a man in search of a rich wife, who comes up upon a likely candidate in Catherine, but she is so cursed and shrewish, which is Elizabethan for mean and awful and horrible to deal with, that the whole show is about him trying to tame her. This is a bit of a non-politically correct issue in contemporary America. We don't really believe in women taming men, and I certainly don't believe in it. So one of the fun things and the challenges about this particular show is finding a way to present this sort of anachronistic plot in a way that people today can believe in and buy and find extremely funny. And I think we've hit upon that method.
Catherine, what do you make of Taming of the Shrew?
Very similar to what Scott says, and I've seen our production that we've done a couple of times, which is really good and really good at interweaving both a modern day, some modern day comedy as well as the old Shakespearean language. And I also saw it done at Ashland this year as well. And I would agree with Scott. It's a very awkward political subject for a lot of women, I think, who come and see it. But the way to approach that is similar to what Scott's done this year with our own production, and that is, you know, you make light of some of the references, which could be which would be considered a little bit sexist in modern day, certainly if it was published on the news or anything like that. But it's an interesting play to do, and it's actually one that's one of the top requested plays by our audience, as is Romeo and Juliet. So Taming of the Shrew and Romeo and Juliet are in the top five requested plays by our audience on a yearly basis.
Let's get back to the other play, Greater Tuna. We talked a bit about it at the beginning, but I'm curious to know, of all the plays in the world that you could have chosen to have as play number three in the festival, what was it about Greater Tuna?
Well, I would say that one of the things that's nice about Greater Tuna is that it is vastly different from Shakespeare. And if you're going to do a play that is not Shakespeare, why not do something that is really a completely change of pace for the audience? So that's one nice thing. Also, we have one stage here, and we're trying to put on three plays so that we have sort of a limited ability to change over play to play to play to play. So it's a play where two actors carry the entire town of Tuna on their backs, and that makes it a possibility for us, but it is absolutely hilarious, and people seem to enjoy really, really funny plays when they go to outdoor venues like this.
Scott, what's it like acting in an outdoor venue? It can be harder to project.
Yes, you certainly have sound issues. We're right here on the lake, so sometimes you hear the sound of the lake. If the wind comes up a little bit, then you have
nice.
To be even a little bit louder than you normally would. And so we definitely search out a group of actors who have big voices, powerful instruments, and who can talk to 1,200 people sitting on the edge of a beautiful natural lake and still capture their attention.
Catherine, let's talk about a couple of logistical issues. Weather. What's the temperature like in the evening where the theater is, and what do you do if it rains?
We've been really lucky this year thus far, and have been actually for the past few years, in that the temperature's only dropping to about 65 after intermission, after the sun's gone down. So people are putting on a jacket maybe around 9:30, 10 o'clock as the play's just coming to a close. If the show becomes subject to rain, then we certainly do cancel the performance, and we honor people's ticket at another performance during the same year, if not next year, if that needs to be, if they're coming from a little further afield. But that's done on a very, very rare basis, touch wood. We don't like to talk about rain too much at our theater.
The thunderstorms are usually more late afternoon, aren't they?
Yes, and sometimes we do have a sprinkling of rain, you know, around about 4:30, and that's happened on occasion. But what that tends to lead to is a more magnificent sunset, so there's an upside to having a little rain shower at about 4:30 in the afternoon.
Scott, as one of the actors, what's your position on rain and weather?
Well, as Catherine said, we've been very fortunate the past few years. We haven't had to deal with it much. We had one pretty serious storm last summer during a production of Twelfth Night where we had to tie ropes around all the scenery to keep it from blowing off the stage. And that one was a little problematic. But we of course, as actors, we're concerned with safety if it rains. But as Catherine says, knock on wood, we haven't had too much of an issue with that. And it's generally just an enormous pleasure performing outside.
Sure. And Catherine, do you need to bring something to sit on?
We actually have chair rentals available at the theater. And for those of your audience who don't know, this is a natural sand amphitheater that's located on the shores of Lake Tahoe. The backdrop, as you mentioned at the top of the story, is the lake itself and the wonderful Sierra Nevada mountain range. So we do rent beach chairs at the theater. We also have a pre-assigned seating section in the front house. But people are more than welcome to bring their own low-back beach chair or a blanket to sit on and enjoy the show. And we have a full-service restaurant at the theater as well, Shakespeare's Kitchen, that is open for 2 hours before the show starts to allow people to go in and enjoy a picnic dinner before the show begins.
Okay, well, the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival just got underway. For a link to more information, go to Insight's webpage, capradio.org/insight. Thanks to our two guests, Catherine Atack, Executive Director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival, and Scott Gilbert, who's an actor and director in the festival. He plays Lord Montague in Romeo and Juliet and directs The Taming of the Shrew. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, how UC Davis scientists helped discover the holy grail of plant biology, the signal that causes plants to flower. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily feed from Insight telling you what's on the next show. Sign up by clicking on the little orange box with the letters RSS at capradio.org/insight. One of the fundamental questions of plant biology is what triggers the flowering of plants? UC Davis scientists recently helped answer that question, led by William Lucas, a professor of plant biology at Davis. The researchers identified the signal that causes plants to flower. The scientific word for this hormone that triggers flowering is florigen. Let's find out more from the man who led the study. William Lucas, welcome to Insight.
Pleasure.
You described this finding as the holy grail of plant biology. What makes this finding so important?
Well, as you know, almost all of our food depends on plants and flowering. So we eat the product of the flower. And for about 150 years or so, plant biologists knew that the plants could tune into the environment, especially the day length, and that controlled in large part when that particular plant would flower, depending on the environment in which it evolved.
And why was there something more to find out? I mean, it sounds like biologists had, and I guess farmers had known for millennia that's what happened.
Yes. Well, of course, you like to know the molecular basis of that induction.
Sure.
Of course, as you know, animals and plants have hormones, and many of those hormones are small molecule secondary metabolites. So for many, many years, plant biologists felt that this florigen, the definition of florigen, is the molecule that moves from the tissue that perceives the signal, the mature leaves. It has to move from that mature leaf all the way to the apex or to the regions of the plant that are capable of producing new tissues, the flowers. And that's quite a long distance. It moves in the vascular system of the plant, the phloem. And so since the around 1940s, plant biologists knew that there was some molecule that was moving, but they didn't know what it was. And so the quest was to find out what was the nature of that florigen.
That's a long time for something to be known about, but not discovered, and given the importance of the florigen, because I guess you could say agriculture is at the foundation of human civilization. And I would imagine there's a lot of people looking into this, and there's a lot of vested interest in this. Why did it take so long?
That's a very good question. It's hard to explain. The tissue is so much the vascular tissue is so much more difficult to access than in animals. Imagine if you went to the doctor and they couldn't draw blood. The diagnosis would be very, very much set back. Well, the vascular system of the plant where this signal is moving is so deep within the tissue, and it's so difficult to extract that blood of the plant, that this held work back for many years until we got greater capacity to look at genomes and to look at to do genetics to find out mutations that actually are slowing down the flowering process or, in fact, stopping it. And that way, the geneticist began to, if you will, set the outer perimeter of what kinds of molecules would be involved. And that's, in fact, what laid the foundation for what we did, because my lab has been working for several decades now on long-distance communication through the phloem. And in 1998-99, we discovered that this pathway carries macromolecules, so proteins and RNA. And, in fact, I placed a bet early on that it would be an RNA molecule, because this would be just so unpredicted by all the.
What do you mean an RNA molecule?
Well, a messenger RNA that was traveling within the phloem that could control that process.
And the phloem is the tissue that carries the nutrients through the plant.
That's right. It's what makes you and me live on the planet.
Now, you said earlier that it's hard to extract the quote-unquote blood of the plant. Tell us more about that. Why is that hard?
Well, because the cells are so small and they're under very high pressure. So, in fact, the pressure in the phloem is higher than the pressure in a jumbo jet tire.
Really?
Yes. I like that. It really amazes people, especially when the plane lands. So when you try to withdraw the phloem sap, naturally the plant has protected itself against damage, and that system seals very effectively. So one of the things that allowed us to have the success in our project was that I learned from my early days of working in the vegetable garden with my mother, that some of the cucurbits are hemophiliacs of the plant kingdom. They're not really hemophiliacs, of course, but what they do is they produce such a very large fruit that they have to compromise the phloem system to make it a very low resistance to the flow of nutrients so that it can grow so large. And of course, we chose to work on Halloween pumpkin, Cucurbita maxima Big Max.
The cucurbits are pumpkins and,
right.
and
yes,
other kinds
yes,
of squash.
Yes. Right, that's yeah. the squashes, yes. And so when you cut, I'm sure most people that have taken their Halloween pumpkin home, and if they break the stem off, they'll see some sap exuding. That's the phloem. So we were able to take these special cucurbits, the squashes, the pumpkins, and make incisions into the vascular tissue. And the very high pressure in there allows us to collect the exuded sap.
What do you mean the vascular tissue? Is that the stringy part of the squash?
That's right. That's right.
And you cut into that, and that's how you get to the sap?
Right, on the stem, not in the fruit itself. But if you cut the fruit, you'll also see the sap coming out. That nice, glistening, sticky material that tastes sweet. That's it.
That's the plant's blood?
That's the plant's blood.
Goodness.
Mm-hmm. Not red, because there's no red blood cells.
Why is it so hard to get to the quote-unquote blood of plants as opposed to humans? I mean, it sounds like it's that way in plants so that they can protect themselves. Is that
That's
right?
That's exactly right.
So why not for us? I mean, I know you're a plant biologist,
yes.
not a human biologist or animal.
Well,
biologist.
Naturally, you have a sealing system, a clotting system in the blood. Of course, if that hadn't evolved, then when you got a cut, you'd be like a hemophiliac and you'd bleed to death.
Yeah.
So both systems have developed their protection. But, you know, if you had the pressure in your veins the same as the pressure in the vascular system of the phloem of the plant, you would be absolutely dead.
My guest is William Lucas. He's professor of plant biology at UC Davis. He and other researchers at Davis and other universities recently published an important study on how plants flower, specifically how the flowering is triggered. And this question had been gone unanswered in a sense for decades, but you could say also for hundreds of thousands of years before that. What are the implications of this scientific discovery? How could this finding of how plants trigger their flowering, how can that benefit society at large?
Right. Well, a lot of plants flower. Let's take an example, onions. So most of you know that when you've got an onion in your store, in your cupboard, it'll eventually start to sprout. If you're growing an onion out in the field and the day length changes to induce it to flower, the farmer has lost the product. Because the inflorescence shoot comes up through the middle of the bulb and you can't use it for anything. So knowing exactly what molecules are involved in inducing flowering, now we can go into those individual agriculturally important crops and begin to modify those receptors, those signaling pathways, so that you can control it so that it doesn't ever flower, or you can control when it will flower. You can control it by natural means, or you can control it by artificial means. So you can chemically induce the pathway. For example, cut flowers, huge business. Now you can use this kind of technology to really regulate when do the roses come out for special occasions.
Mm.
So this is just one application. You can now also control the timing of flowering, the extent of flowering. These sort of opportunities, I think, will be quite invaluable for modern agriculture.
Yes, I can see that. Now, you mentioned earlier being in the vegetable garden with your mother. Mm. You spend your time in a plant biology lab. Do you still enjoy cultivating plants?
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. I have my own vegetable garden, of course. What did I have for breakfast? Of course, I had tomatoes. I grow quite a lot of my own vegetables. There's a pleasure to simply watching the process. I think the most important thing, though, was when my mother used to take me as a child, and she'd ask me, look at these two different flowers on the same bush. How can they have a different color? And there must be something very unusual going on. And, of course, it was many, many decades later that we discovered that this relates to RNA interference, which is one of the greatest discoveries of recent times in terms of control on processes. And what she was looking at was some of the early observations of gene silencing going on and changing the color in the flowers.
Mm.
And she was very smart because she could keep the seeds and would recognize that those traits could carry on to the next generation, but then eventually would be lost because they're epigenetic. And so she started me thinking about how can these sort of processes exist? They are not really simple genetic traits. So you can learn a lot from your mother.
Are you a better gardener because you're a scientist?
Oh, I think, as my mother used to say, you're a gardener if you have a green thumb. And I think that it comes out of the natural way to look at the plants and to realize what do they need to be healthy. And I think a lot of plant biologists actually have very poor green thumbs. They're very good in the lab, but not so good when it comes to the garden.
Yeah.
In fact, some of my own faculty will say that I'm very bad at the houseplants inside of my own department, so they have somebody to take care of them for me.
Now, the research that we're talking about here was led by you at UC Davis, but there were other collaborators in Arizona and New Zealand and Mexico. How does that work?
Right. Well, most science today is a cooperation of individuals with different talents and different expertise. The colleague in Arizona, Rich Jorgensen's lab, it was earlier at UCD, so natural friendship and cooperation had gone on for a long time. He's also an expert at looking at evolutionary components of genes and making sure that we understand how they fit together, and that was his major job. Tony Locke from Agrigenesis in New Zealand is a small biotech company started by a friend of mine from many, many years ago. And Tony and I have been working together for about 15 years as a natural friendship on RNA molecules moving in the long-distance transport system. So it just is a natural progression of overlapping interest. And, of course, working with people in New Zealand is a great opportunity to be able to go and work in other countries. And, in fact, some of the early work that gave rise to this was done when I was in sabbatical in New Zealand, in his institute.
You're from Australia, though, aren't you?
Yes, I'm from Australia.
Yeah.
But I also like the Kiwis.
Now, this was a big deal, this discovery, how plants flower. Are there other big discoveries still to be made in your field?
Oh, I think there are always big discoveries to be made.
No.
I think one of the most important things that's coming out and that, you know, will come out in the future is the understanding of how all these genes interact together to allow the plant to be really effective in terms of fitness for its environment. And this is why I'm spending my lab focuses on this long distance component of signaling, because a lot of plant biologists work on individual tissues and cells, but our goal is to figure out how all the signals come together to make an integrative network so that the plant can respond to so many different things, because unlike humans or animals, the plant can't get up and walk away from the stress. And in fact, that's why many plants have more genes than you or I, because they have to really contend with so many more inputs, both environmental inputs as well as developmental plasticity.
Yes, I see. Well, William Lucas, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
William Lucas is professor of plant biology at UC Davis. He and other researchers recently published an important study on how plants flower, specifically how the flowering is triggered. The hormone that triggers the flowering is called a florigen. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, Chinese parents used to struggle to raise a lot of kids who would support them in old age. Now they pour all their hopes and resources into just one. Millions of these only children are coming of age. And that story and the day's news are coming up next on The World. Today's associate producer was Jennifer Plasmeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Thank you. Cities located in Middle America lead the U.S. in volunteering, according to a new study. On the next Insight, how does the Sacramento region stack up against the nation when it comes to volunteering? Plus, a local volunteer agency tells you how to get involved. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.